such soothing music to get us waking up here in the morning. This is KWMR, 90.5 Point Reyes Station, 89.9 Bolinas, and 92.3 San Geronimo Valley. Coming up here is the Westmoor Naturalist Hour with myself, Seamus, Dallas, and Liz. We're all in the studio today. Liz has a quick message for us before I turn to our intro song. Oh, let's get you plugged in here. All right, cue you up. There we go.
KWMR is underwritten by Bear Valley Cottage in Olema. Information on this self-catering cottage available at bearvalleycottage.com.
All right, we'll be with you in a moment. Here's our little tune made by yours truly. In the studio. Yeah, good to see you all.
Yeah, good morning. Good morning.
Yeah. It's been so long since I've seen you.
I know. But today's going to be fun. I'm excited about today. We're going to get weird here on the show. I think it's going to get a little weird.
I'm excited to get weird.
Today is all about oddities out here in West Marin in the natural world. So, yeah, we're going to talk about weird things we've seen out here, or witnessed, heard, experienced.
Mostly in nature. You know, whether it be the land or the water.
Yeah.
And we're asking for you guys to call in, too.
Yeah.
You know, this is the day that we're definitely inviting everybody to call in. Phone number here is 415-663-8492. Again, that's 663-8492. So if you have your own oddities and you want to, you know, I'm not sure if it's explained or not, feel free to call us in.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's tell us about your interesting, strange
Experiences
out here. Yeah.
All right.
For sure.
Before we do that, let's jump into some weather and some tides. Looks like the next week is pretty similar to the last week. Sunny and warm with about a high of 62 degrees for the next week.
Oh.
Lows at nighttime in the mid-40s.
Ooh.
Not too much wind either, so it looks like it should be pretty mild.
Mm.
Tides for Marshall, California. Our next high tide is 4.9 feet at 1:27 p.m. And our next low tide is -0.4 at 9:17 p.m.
So that's pretty low.
Got some water moving. Yeah, totally.
Yeah, I noticed
low tides. That's good for finding oddities.
Absolutely. In fact, looking at some of our things we're going to talk about today, there's a lot of strange things in like the intertidal zone, muddy bottom bay.
Yeah.
We get out here in Tomales Bay, and there's just a lot of weird things, especially in that kind of life zone.
Is it weird because we don't live in the mud?
Most likely.
Probably. Yeah. I can say weird. Weird is it?
Right.
It's
subjective.
Subjective. That's what I'm looking at. Weird is like subjective to the person experiencing it because it's not
totally. And it's not as common.
As common. Yeah.
And I think that's why the places like that in the intertidal zone are really exposed to that because they're only shown to us like a few times a year.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, pretty odd.
Yeah, and things just they're especially in the like intertidal zones. Everything's. I mean, it seems like life is just about hanging on and moving slow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think under that premise, things tend to get, the evolutionary adaptations are things that are unique to us,
Totally. Yeah, and a lot of them, you know, we actually, Liz and I have been posting on our social media, on Point Reyes Venture Co.'s social media. Like this first one was a polychaete worm, a bristle worm. We actually found, they go by lots of different names. I think there's over 138 species of polychaetes that are found in Tamales Bay. And Liz,
how many are there worldwide then? There's 138
in our
little
Google.
I don't know. While Liz is doing that, I want to do a quick Google.
Yeah.
What else do you want me to say about them? No, 138 species makes me wonder how many different types of worms are in just like the earth, because I only think of earthworms. Like there are a bunch of different kind of worms, or is it just in the intertidal zone that they get so diversified and specialized?
So it sounds like there are over 13,000 described species of polychaetes in the world.
Wow.
I know, right? Pretty wild. The one that we saw was like a commonly called like a king ragworm. It looks like a rainbow colored. A lot of that's due to like the reflection and refraction of light in the body. And what we were looking at the meaning of polychaete.
Of polychaete, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you looked it up. I don't remember.
Polly's like multiple.
And keep meaning bristles. Sorry, I thought that was something you did this morning. So, no, it's, poly meaning multiple and keep meaning bristles. So it's like many bristles. So, you know, they look a lot like little.
What's a bristle?
Like
how they move around. So on that polychaete worm that was on our social media, they look like a centipede. But there's also the fat innkeeper worm, which we'll come back to in a little bit. They are also a polychaete, but they're more smooth, and so their bristles are just, like, finer.
Bristles are like their feet.
Mm-hmm. No, bristles like on a brush, right? Like lots of them that help them move around.
Yeah.
And they use them like their feet, exactly.
Oh, okay.
I think of bristle like the adjective. Like, you know, I'm all bristled. Right? That's an adjective?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm bristling right now.
Does this show make you nervous?
Totally, right? Cool part about these guys, too, they also have, like, an irreversible jaw, which is, like, the innards come out of their mouth.
So
it looks kind of like a secondary mouth that comes out. If anyone's ever watched Beetlejuice, the sandworms, that kind
of thing. Or, like, Alien movies.
Yes, yeah, like that. Alien movies, totally. That's, like, the innards that come out there. So that looks a little pretty wild when you see them, and then you see them feeding like that.
You've seen them feeding like that?
Yeah.
That's totally crazy.
It's pretty wild. Yeah. I've only seen two of them ever, but they're pretty commonly used for bait out here, so I know a lot of fishermen probably have more experience with them because they're great for perch.
And like if you're clamming, I imagine you would run into them a lot more than when we're just gliding over eelgrass beds.
Mm-hmm. Where in what context do you normally see them? Because I don't feel like I see them very often out here. Any of this like multiple
mud
species.
Flats.
Mud flats.
Mud flats in the mud flats for sure. Yeah. Which is probably where most of this stuff is going to be found. And a lot of times it's going to spend most of its time in the mud, though there are some times that we do see them in the water. So we do our bioluminescence tours at nighttime, and sometimes we'll see this in the bioluminescence. You'll see something that's already bioluminescing by itself.
Yes, I definitely wanted to talk about this. This is fascinating.
Yeah, and as guys, we've been talking about it for a few years. We couldn't really figure out exactly what it was, but you see these like long lines of it that kind of collect in the current. It turns out they're like polychaetes that come up on the new moon and they broadcast spawn and their spawn is bioluminescent, so we are lucky enough to see that sometimes in the water.
I've seen it in the tent. In fact recently I just saw it a few months ago, I think, at this point. And it seems like it's on the new moon, right? Like it seems like very specific times where this appears. I've only seen it twice in the last like 9 years.
Mm-hmm.
So but it looks like almost the legs of jelly. Like I know my guests that were on the water with me saw. They're like, oh, jellyfish are lighting up,
right?
Because it kind of looks like it's kind of globular, kind of stringy. It almost looks like a jellyfish bioluminescing, and it's actually this worm sperm.
Totally. And you know, it's a lot of time it is on new moons, and a lot of species are more active on new moons, and that's because there's less moonlight, less light, so they're less likely to be eaten by predators.
So
that's why we tend to see more things on the new moons, which is fun for us to go out there as paddlers on those nights, because there's a lot of stuff that lights up that bioluminescence that you might not see normally.
Yeah.
And I'm sure it's just like a sensitivity to the amount of light in the sky, but I do just find it fascinating that there's so many things in the natural world that are affected by the moon cycle. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Whether it's the new or the full. That always has intrigued me.
Is it every new moon that these polychaetes do it? Or
no.
Yeah, because I was going to say, it's a rarity to see.
Exactly. I think it's more in the summer, you know, in fall.
Yeah, and everyone knows, you know, we talk about on our show often, like we go out there and see the bioluminescence by these little dinoflagellates, these, you know, little single cellular organisms that light up. And that's the common bioluminescence to see out here. But this is like, it stays lit, right? Mm-hmm. It's like this long streaks.
And you don't have to agitate it. Usually you have to, like, it's our paddle strokes, our boats, or a fish going through that lights up the bioluminescence. But this will be paddling, and you'll see it lighting up in the distance, and you're like, wait a second, what is that?
Yeah, it's very definitive. Like, it's very, very bright. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, it's kind of interesting that we're looking at.
I feel like it's also tends to be more green.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
Because I tend to see the bioluminescence as, like, more of a blue tone to it. And I feel like when I see the polychaetes broadcast stuff, that looks more green.
Interesting.
And actually, that's something I'd love to do a whole other
color
show about, as a color. You know,
if there's any
spectrum,
color specialists out there, please hit us up.
We see light so differently, and you know, just like on a brief tangent, you know, talking about ravens, you know, like ravens to us look so black, but apparently to all other birds, they look like
rainbow crow.
Like, yeah, rainbow crows, like parrots, they're like so super bright.
Huh.
It's just that on a spectrum that our eyes can't really see that color spectrum.
Interesting.
Interesting.
You know, one thing I've learned about bioluminescence, especially in the water, is white and blue light travel better. So more things that bioluminesce in the water tend to be on that end of this light spectrum because it travels better in the water. It's interesting. I never thought maybe it was a little green. I'm trying to remember how I felt about that, the color of the – it's bright.
It's bright.
Yeah.
I can see it.
why do you think they do that? Why do you think they are lighting up their sperm?
I don't think they are. I think it's that it's sticky and the bioluminescent dinoflagellates get attached to it and congregate around it. Am I correct in that? Is that?
I think that. I'm actually not 100% positive on that. You know, I would assume that it would be for attracting more mates.
Yeah, you know? It's got to be something.
And then also, maybe synchronizing spawning. You know, like so there's like more of them know it's happening at once, so they have these spawning events. Because I know a lot of species do that, and there's
got to keep the genetic pool diverse.
Right, but that's
I would argue it may not have to be dinoflagellates in there because when dinoflagellates light up, it just bloop, you know, and their cellular wall.
But haven't you seen it like when it'll stick to your hand and it stays lit up?
For like a couple seconds.
Yeah, but if you have like millions of little dinoflagellates all along this sticky thread, that's then getting pushed up into a current. It's just my hypothesis.
Okay. It's not a bad one.
I think it's great. Yeah.
Anyways, and how many species are in the smallest bay of these worms?
138.
13,000 total.
That's
worldwide.
That's wild.
There's a lot of
weird stuff in the mud.
Yeah.
You know? That's kind of why I love low tides and going out there, because a lot of folks would just kind of look at the mud flats and like, oh.
I don't want to get my feet muddy.
Yeah, well, and then you're walking through there and then it's like, oh, there's nothing here. And it's kind of like when people take people to the desert for the first time. Like, you just got to look a little closer and you're like, whoa, wait, everything's alive. Where do I step?
You're like that Edward Abbey quote. Like, you got to get down on your hands and knees and crawl around in the dirt and you still might not see anything.
I remember that
His
quote.
Love for the desert.
Yeah. It's true. A lot of things. A lot of these things you see, that's a good parallel with the desert because it's like there's a lot of subtleties that are actually really exceptional to witness, but you have to really kind of know what you're looking for sometimes.
Slow down, pay attention.
Totally.
Yeah. So talk about this penis fish.
Before we jump in, the next one is definitely the penis fish. I'm also going to put the phone number out there one more time for everybody in between these. The phone number is 415-663-8492. Again, it's 415-663-8492. If you have your own oddity or even something to share about any of these fun things that we're talking about, feel free to call in.
Yeah.
I know Ranger Fiona does not want to talk about penis fish ever again.
It was
but she's welcome
things.
To call in.
Totally. You know, I've heard this because, you know, there was a big wash-up and was...
Oh, spoiler alert. Aren't we playing a song first?
Oh, okay. Are we going to play a song?
Oh, no, go ahead.
Whatever you
I say. Misunderstood you. On with the penis fish.
We have a penis fish song?
No, I was going to say that. I probably could have found some songs for it, but I did not because it's
didn't
9 to 10.
Go down that rabbit hole, huh?
No, we can play a song a little bit. Let's actually go jump right in the fat innkeeper worm, otherwise known as the penis fish.
Yeah.
Not actually a fish at all, but they got pretty famous out here because there was in December of 2019, there was thousands
Only that
of
long
them.
Ago.
Yeah, it wasn't that long ago, because I remember, like,
there was a whole global pandemic in the mix that kind of
seemed longer, right?
Seems longer ago.
But when it happened, everybody wanted to come out and see the penis fish. And they
really?
Were, I mean, because there are thousands of them, of course, obviously, as you can guess, a lot of the newspapers and the other things kind of grabbed onto the article.
Sure.
The photo.
Quite the visual.
Yeah, it was quite the visual.
Thousands.
Exactly. And then as guides and as rangers, you know, people would come out here all the time, like, how do I see the penis fish? And it was like one of the most common questions for like 2 years, you know? And it was like, it was just a one-day wash-up. And it was kind of interesting about, you know, about
Did you say it was in December?
Yes.
Ooh.
Any ideas why we had all those big wash-ups?
I think I know.
Yeah, hand
raised. I'm raised my hand.
This is all new to me.
Oh,
I think
really?
I remember,
what's
I think
your
I
guess,
remember something about that,
yeah.
why they washed up.
Yeah.
Because they're normally in the mud, right?
Like, right. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah.
And
right.
It was December.
Big storm? Was it a big storm?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, a big storm, big waves, washed away because they're in the burrows and the muds. Yeah. And those big waves came through, washed all of those out.
Like literally washed all the sand off the beach.
Correct. Yep. Exactly. Yeah. And in that sand was one of the biggest colonies of the fat innkeeper worms, and they just kind of washed up onto the beach in thousands. And most of the time, people don't see them. The only time you really do see them is if, like, again, you're going clamming.
Yeah.
Or
you have to really go looking for them.
Yeah, sometimes you see them.
Some people eat them.
Yeah, and you
what?
See.
What? Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
really?
Totally. Yeah, it's more common in Asia, you know.
A delicacy.
And there's sea otters actually eat them quite often.
Oh,
so sometimes,
they eat every... Wait, sea otters or river otters?
Sea otters.
Oh, sea otters.
You know, so sometimes you'll see them, and I mean, they're like, they're big, you know, big fat innkeeper worms, you know.
Oh,
so
wow.
People are like, wait, what's that thing eating?
For those of you who can't see, Dallas just put his hands up about
no.
the size of a ruler, 12 inches.
Yeah. Wow.
Huh. Yeah. Yep. So it's, you know, and...
How do you prepare them? If you were to eat them, like we were like, if I was to harvest innkeeper worms, like how it, you know,
is this what you're bringing to the Friendsgiving?
Just found out you can eat these guys.
Oh, also, fun fact that I was learning about them is that they feed on the plankton using a mucus net.
Oh wow!
Yeah.
So they create a net like, between themselves, or just like kind of send out a net.
Good question.
Yeah.
And I'm like looking up how people prepare them. Most of the time they eat it raw, which I'm not too
drawn to. This is getting weirder and weirder.
I was thinking more like calamari. I could maybe
like
do.
They do like a gochujang sauce, you know, or sesame oil or salt dip. They can also saute it with kimchi or grill them. I would be more inclined to grill them or saute them. But, you know.
But people eat them raw.
Yeah, totally.
That's crazy.
I would probably at least try, I guess, if someone of us was someone who
knew what they were doing.
Yeah.
Do you have to pick out the bristles?
I have no idea.
Yeah. No idea. This is all, you know, all new to me.
And how, because I don't think I've ever seen them. Like, what do they look like? Describe what they're.
They're called a penis fish.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, I'm not going to go into description.
All right. So
I don't think we're allowed to do that on air.
We'll allow the audience to use their imagination.
Yeah, it's literally enough.
I mean, how big are they, though?
I mean,
oh, my.
I'm showing the photo.
I think I have seen pictures of those before. It actually looks like a bunch of fingers.
Yeah, totally. Absolutely.
Severed
so,
fingers.
Yeah. You know, so, and people
I would not want to eat that raw. That would be an adventure.
Yeah, like, it would be an adventure.
How do you feel about oysters?
But it's oysters. Yeah. I was going to say, if you think about, like, with oysters, you know. So.
Yeah, but they have a shell. I don't know. There's something about. You're right. It's, again, a lot of times food is very cultural, and so what's.
Yep.
Right.
You know,
exactly,
absolutely.
Right. So. It's just, again, I'd have to be with someone who had to show me how to prepare it.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah, and kind of prepare me on what to expect.
But yeah, with food,
I think you shouldn't
is...
prepare somebody for what to expect with that. You just like, this is this beautiful thing that I know how to make. I think that's how you treat odd foods.
Mm-hmm. Just give them
odd to us.
Fully
foods.
Plated.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've been pretty adventurous with my food, you know, during my lifetime.
Yeah.
And that would be, you know, Let's cook up some penis fish. let's do it.
Thanksgiving's coming up, y'all. We have some more oddities coming up here. I think before that, we're going to jump into a song real fast. We've got a few. I had a lot of fun looking up some oddity songs this morning for you guys.
Yeah, you did.
Want to go to Beelzebub?
Yeah.
I think that was a fun one. This is by Les Claypool and Beats Antique. Les Claypool's in Sebastopol and really famous bassist. And Beats Antique does a lot of fun dance music. And it's odd for you. So
nice. Right. And then also, just a reminder, you can call in today if you're feeling inspired to tell us about some strange thing you've seen out here in the natural world. either in West Marin or beyond, feel free to call 415-663-8492 or okay. There's two phone numbers.
Just
isn't there?
Do 8492.
Yeah.
8492.
Can I also interject that it doesn't have to be something silly? It could also be something like profound or just rare or actually, something that gave you a little head scratcher.
Yeah.
We're being a little silly this morning, yeah. But it's Monday morning.
Yeah, it's hard not to when you're talking about penis.
It's penis. True.
Totally, it's true. Yeah.
So, anyways, here we go. We'll be back after this song.
That was a wild good
time there. Very, very fitting for the show. And today, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to the West Marin Naturalist Hour, and we are talking about oddities in nature here in West Marin and beyond. And we've been getting silly, but feel free to call in with your stories. We have one caller on the line, and that is Claire. Claire, can you hear us?
I can.
Oh, great.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for the show.
Yeah.
It's hilarious.
Thank you for calling in.
You know, I remember learning about what I'm going to call the fat innkeeper worm.
Yes.
Yep.
The preferred name for
very
that.
Very demure.
Totally.
Yeah, I was looking up the meaning for its scientific name, and it has to do with innkeeper or host. Hmm. So I just thought people might appreciate knowing how this worm supports fellow beings in the subtitle.
Yeah.
because it has a big burrow, it has a big pump-like body, it has a mucus net that it casts inside the burrow.
Oh.
And little particles of food stick to that. Then it sucks it all in, and particles fall off its quote-unquote mouth, its mucus net, and the commensal organisms that live with or near the fat innkeeper get to gobble up those little morsels.
Oh, interesting.
Four different kinds, right? There's a little goby that swims around the outside and hangs out. There's a little pea crab that's adapted to live in the burrow. It's like got a long side-to-side shell or test.
Oh, wow.
There's another worm. There's a little clam, I think, that hangs around the outside of the burrow and just sends its siphon down into the burrow where this lush mucus net is yielding little food scraps. And the fat innkeeper gets nothing except good karma.
Wow. Oh, there, as we're seeing it in the burrow.
Like mutual. Yeah. It's a host.
Yeah, so it sounds like it creates its own ecosystem for a bunch of different species.
Well, in a way, yeah, its own little community, and it has, you know, it has its protection down in the mud until something happens, like the whole mud flat gets overturned in a storm, and they all get deposited on the shore and die.
Right.
But that, I guess, is life in the intertidal. But I just thought that hosting.
That's really cool. Yeah.
Would be a good Thanksgiving, inspiration for all
Absolutely.
Of us. Yeah. Hats off to the fat innkeeper worm. It's preferred.
And have you, by the way, eaten it as a delicacy or
No, I've never considered it, and I don't now.
Yes. I know. And it's cool.
Inside of that elucidation. Yeah.
I didn't realize that there was the specific, like, pea crab and goby that are there. That,
yeah, I knew,
that,
like,
really cool.
Other things hung out with it, but I didn't realize it was, like, this very niche community.
Yeah, as I understand it, they're, at least for the little pea crab, that's its home place. So you wonder how they mate, you know, and find others of their own kind and have, like, communion. But that's another story, I guess.
Probably has something to do with the moon.
But I have another observation for you.
Yeah.
Just this past weekend, actually, it was Saturday morning. I was on my way home from the Sacramento Valley, where we went for a couple days of looking at the throngs and throngs of snow geese and ibis and swans and all the hawks and eagles. And it's wintertime wonder up there if it's not totally foggy. But the fog on Saturday morning was lighting up all of the spider tent webs on the ground, and they were legion. There was hardly any space between them.
Oh, wow.
So it was misty, and it was this silver carpet along the trail side of all of these little vortex-shaped blankets. Some of them were quite large, and I learned that they just stay there. They don't get rewoven all the time, and the spider will repair them. They jump out of the tunnel and chase down something, like a little wolf, I guess, a wolf spider. Uh-huh. And that was pretty impressive. But later in the day, this was the big one. It warmed up. It got calm and clear and quite balmy. And the day before had also warmed up in the afternoon. Then I was at Calusa National Wildlife Refuge in the presence of all of these geese swirling around in the air, coming and going. And I was having a snack in the parking lot, and I looked straight up in the air thinking, well, maybe it'll be a bald eagle going over real high. And I saw this wad of white, and it was long and strandy, but it was goopy, and it was a wad. And I thought, oh, God, it's a deflated helium balloon from some kid's
that big
party. It looked large from down below. Yeah, it was up a couple hundred feet, and it was catching the sunlight. Then I noticed more, and then more. Then I took a on a sunny nature trail, and it was like like swathed in strands of cobweb. But what was going on up above was the baby spiders taking off.
What?
To float away on the spider silk. And yeah. they will take a warm day in the winter at that right after some cold weather, yeah. and they'll all just go. Millions of them. That phenomenon of the floating spider silk was thick and long lasting for many miles on my drive home. It made driving very unsafe for me.
That is wild.
It was draping all of the big lampposts for the big highway lights. It was cool. Floating in front of my car. It was way high overhead. And so it turns out that countless baby spiders all took off on the same weather front. And I'm now learning how they learn how to launch. And it's not just on the wind. They ride the electromagnetic field of the Earth.
Ooh.
They charge their strand of web, a negative and positive, to lift off into the atmosphere.
Yeah.
It's phenomenal what's known about these creatures. I don't know the species, and it's more than one, but
what an amazing oddity.
That is so cool. I'm doing just a little research on there too. They call it ballooning, and they're saying that some of these species can like travel hundreds of miles and up to 3 miles in altitude, and especially the ones that are able to utilize those electrostatic fields.
Little baby spiders on a magic carpet ride of silk. That's amazing.
Yeah, I think there was some notes online here not long ago. Dewey Livingston, or I think it was, encountered a whole bunch of this white strandy stuff on the ground, and he thought it was plastic. It's that strong, but it was the fallen strands. And just a further footnote, this fellow who's a physicist, I think, based in Hawaii and also a sailor, was reading The Voyage of the Beagle and learned that Charles Darwin had witnessed this whole thing happen, a spider ballooning off the rail of the boat. And he got real interested in how they do it. And he's the one who figured out that it's a charged particle kind of thing. In collaboration with another artist. He's going to be on Bay Nature Talk on Wednesday of next week, or the first Wednesday in December, I think it is.
Ooh,
and
cool.
They do a lot of fantastic hour-long noontime lectures that are derived from he's also featured in the magazine in an article about this very thing. So I got to see it in real life, and I'm stoked.
That is amazing. And is it just a specific species of spider that does this ballooning, or is it multiple different species?
No, it seems like it's a lot of kinds. They're in a couple of different forms, but a lot of different species. I can't tell you which. But the fact that there could be, obviously, a lot of habitat for spiders from what I saw in the dewy morning and on the sunny nature trail. But this represents the next generation. And so probably being an arachnid, each adult makes a lot of young to give them a chance to all survive, you know. Yeah. And all of them had chosen Saturday morning to go along.
Beautiful weather too.
Yeah,
it was fabulous.
Amazing. That is awe inspiring.
It's cool because it's also one of those things that I've seen and I wonder about it, but I never really fully followed up on it. Yeah. So now it's like a whole nother little.
And they're basically just they're going out there to find their a new habitat, right? For them to settle into.
They have to disperse.
Yeah.
Right.
I don't know what happens at the other end of their voyage. They must land on some favorable spot if they're lucky.
Yeah, if they're lucky.
Set up life and reproduce and make the whole thing happen again.
Yeah. Wow,
that's so cool.
It's just so beautiful and so abundant and so timeless, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's also really interesting. Conditions got to be like just so for this all to take place, kind of like the bioluminescent polychaete worm, you know, like the fifth night after a waning blood moon, everything, you know, I'm joking, but like really specific, you know, windows where these amazing things happen.
And that they know.
Yes, they've adapted to that.
Also, like we were talking about the monarchs on a recent show too, like they know. Yeah. They go and they know where to go and what to do, and it's, you know, millennia of evolution. Yeah. That gets them there?
It's quite inspiring.
Yeah.
The wisdom in Earth life.
Mm-hmm.
And we're just watching from our human form and giving praise.
Mm-hmm.
So thankful for that. Thankful for your show. And carry on, y'all.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Claire. I'm so glad you called in.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
You're welcome.
Have a great day.
And just a reminder to our listeners, if you have your oddity you want to call in and talk about in the natural world, call in at 415-663-8492.
All right. And Liz has something real fast before we jump into our next.
High-speed internet services for KWMR are underwritten by Horizon Cable, online at horizoncable.com.
All right. You know, talking about spiders, it does make a few think of two different things. This first one wasn't on our list, and it's not quite local, but it just, you know, it is odd, and it happened recently.
I think I know where we're going to go with this, because we recently talked about this.
Totally, the world's largest spider web was recently found.
They document this?
I think, you know, it's the largest known spider web in a cave, you know. It's in the border of Greece and Albania, and it spans approximately 1,000 feet.
Oh, my.
And it's thicker than a carpet in most places. So
what?
Like 3 inches thick, and there's over 100,000 species of
spiders.
3 inches
thick?
Yeah, like real thick carpet,
oh,
you
wow.
know, and like over 100,000 species of spiders living in them, many of them which were like enemies to each other, but because it's so dark and like such a large web, they didn't know they were sharing the same web.
Oh, so there's multiple species of spiders
over
living in this communal spider web. Yeah. Wow, there's a metaphor.
Did one
there.
Of them make the web, or was it like...
Together, you know. No, communally. You know.
Wow.
I don't think communally.
But like they didn't even know.
Kind of thing, yeah, because it's completely dark where they're at.
Yeah.
You know, so.
And it just ends up stranding together, whatever they're
But there's communication, like the vibration and stuff happens through.
And it's over 100,000 spiders of two different species. And those two species are actually the type of species that are enemies to each other. But together they have built this together, which is kind of cool.
That's fascinating.
Right. But that brings me to something more local spider webs that we have on our list.
Very cool.
The turret spiders. Have you ever seen a turret spider before?
I don't know if I have.
So they have these like small little
turret.
Like turret tubes, you know, they live in.
Like a little castle.
Okay.
Yeah, to like little castles, exactly.
Little topper. If you can't see what I'm doing with my hands.
This is radio.
I mean, to me, it looks like you're raising the roof.
But yeah, so like what Liz is describing over there with her hands is the fact that they're like anywhere from 2 to 5 inches tall, and they're going to be usually about an inch wide, and they're hollow on the inside.
What are they made of? Like mud? Or?
Usually like a web and like all types of terrain that
the
around
stuff
them.
That sticks to it.
Yeah. So when I saw them, I saw them on the coastal trail, and they were like in a bunch of pine needles, and they'd use the pine needles and made these really like almost like you'd see like tube worms or anything like that.
I was thinking Andy Goldsworthy.
Oh,
were you?
Well. Yeah. The little castles, they use the gooiness of their web, right? Mm-hmm. The stickiness of the web, and then just tape things together to make a little tower.
Yeah, and it's, you know, they're kind of wild because, like, they're really small. The only reason we happen to see them is we just happen to stop for a break, you know, and you're backpacking, so you're, like, bent over, breathing hard, and you're like, oh, look, here we go. Here's a turret spider.
Technical assistance.
Okay. Totally. They build silk and debris burrow tunnels is what they build out there.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, what a different adaptation than building a web. You build a tube.
Any guess?
I think it gives... Why? Oh, can I guess? Do you have an answer, but I can guess?
Yes.
Okay. Totally. My guess would be that then it can get up on top of its little turret and take off.
Oh.
Right? So it can... However spiders...
A balloon? You think? You're ballooning? Do they think they balloon too?
A very micro balloon.
Do more species balloon than I realize?
No, they actually, what they're doing is ambushing small insects.
I was going that direction.
That's
okay.
exactly what they'll do. Is they'll use that to sort of
a little
hidey hole, you know, and they'll wait till they come by and they'll
and
jump out and snatch them and bring them
back. That was kind of, I thought maybe they were gonna, like luring them into the
hole. So I think these are like similar to what Claire was talking about. like that type of spider. Mm-hmm. There's probably several different species that ambush like that.
Yeah, and they're endemic here to our forests. Mm. You know,
very cool.
So where
cool.
where would you normally find these little turrets?
Like in the duff.
In the duff. You know, leaf litter, pretty
wow.
much. Yeah.
How cool. What an interesting strategy. You know, just pop out of a little
boo.
Totally.
Yeah. But I would have thought they maybe like lured prey into the, some special thing that might attract prey into the turret, and then they like munch on them, but they jump out. Huh?
Yeah, totally. Mostly they jump out. I'm doing a little more research on that. I think they may probably, I would assume they'd probably, I'm trying to show you a photo here. That's kind of what a photo is. A lot of the times they blend into the duff. They just kind of look like a hole in the ground.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, but it definitely looks like a little, I thought they were more of like a little spiraling turret, but mm-hmm. it looks like a, kind of more like a little tunnel fort.
Mm-hmm. They're not very big at all.
They're spider. That's very big for a spider.
Is it?
Yeah, I said.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, totally.
This is making hand gestures again.
Like, so, I mean, how big are these turrets? I said
2 to 5 inches,
two to five inches,
I was actually a little bit off on that. I think 2 inches is about as tall as they get.
Okay.
You know,
all
so
right.
They're usually quite small.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting. I've never heard of that before. Yeah. Well, and one of the things I love about this show is the amount of things we get to learn, especially on a show like Oddities, where it's all about learning about strange things. Could we get into parasites?
Yeah.
Oh,
there's a lot of
weird. We all had an experience
there.
At the boat
yes.
ramp the other day.
Setting the premise, and someone else is welcome to kind of set the premise. But I remember there was a fisherman a few weeks ago coming in, bringing his catch or checking out his catch.
Family. They were very cute.
Yeah.
Showed us what they caught.
Yeah, were showing us what they caught, and I was kind of like getting ready for the. I wasn't really tuning in, and then I heard, oh, here's another parasite. Like, ooh, like do tell. So mm-hmm. I kind of go over there, and this guy was really knowledgeable. He knew a lot about it.
Super smart, yeah.
And it was, I mean, these things. Did he pull them out of the mouth of the fish?
He did. He pulled it out.
Yeah,
with
and
like
was
pliers.
More than one. And this parasite I'd never known anything about. It looks like an albino cockroach.
Mm-hmm.
You know, look like a big cockroach, right?
Yeah, you know, or like kind of like a chitin too.
Yeah, yeah, kind of has like a segmented back, mm-hmm. like you would see on the rock, like a chitin.
Mm-hmm.
But it had all these little, you know,
which look like feet. Cockroaches
like,
of the sea.
Yeah, they look like cockroaches of the sea, and I was like, ooh. Then he started explaining mm-hmm. how this parasite gets on the fish and what it does. You know, you all want to jump in there because this is wild.
Yeah, so they have a few other names. The tongue eating louse is the other thing. What it's usually called, the different types of louse, and apparently the ones that we saw there just attach themselves inside of the mouth, and then they'll basically filter in all the food from the fish and then just eat it all away. But there is other species of louse that are out there, more typically found like in Central California, that eat the tongue entirely of the fish and completely replace the tongue.
Okay, so these ones we saw just sit on top of the tongue.
Exactly. I did a little more research because, you know, there are ones that replace the tongue. And,
yeah.
But even that being said.
Side note, didn't know fish had tongues.
This one won't actually.
Right? I mean, like, they have gills. What do they need a tongue for?
That's true. I've never seen the fish lick anything, so. that would be an oddity right there.
Yeah, right, totally. Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, so they sit on the tongue and it kind of becomes the tongue and takes in the nutrients, right?
Is
the idea of these things.
Totally.
Preventing the fish from getting nutrients.
Yeah, I was wondering if it co-survives with this fish or if it ends up
I think it's good for the fish.
Yeah,
ultimately it'll kill the fish.
It'll kill the fish. Yeah. Kind of starve to death.
Mm-hmm.
But man,
which sounds terrible.
They're big and they're in big fish, right? I don't know what. And he pulled up a strange fish I had never seen before.
Yeah, so I think when he pulled up, that was most likely a sculpin. That we're seeing is a large sculpin. Usually see sculpin that are much smaller,
right.
but
there's also a larger sculpin.
That are like
sculpin.
About a foot long. And I think that was what was in the mouth of. I don't remember what.
There was something else that was in the mouth.
Was it in
the
lingcod? Because he also
I think it was.
Lingcods are pretty big, and they've got more of a toothy mouth, but, still.
Yeah. Because he pulled a couple of them out of fish, and they had a few different species of fish in there, so I'm not exactly. I didn't see which one's which. And then a seagull came and ate.
It did. It came and ate.
I wonder how that was.
Isn't that like the next line in the series, because like parasites have a whole like series of hosts that they have to do certain things in?
Yeah.
And I think then it goes into the bird. And then what happens in the bird, Dallas?
There's another species of parasite. I'm blanking on the name on it right now. I'll do a little research in a second. But there is another parasite that's out there that affects the fish, makes them get really erratic and swim really erratic, and makes them go towards the surface of the sea more, and then are more likely to be eaten by birds at that point, which is the ultimate goal of the parasite, because it actually needs to be in a bird first, but it comes from the ocean. So it's
interesting.
It's kind of a weird adaptation.
Like, I got to get on land.
Right.
Oh, wow. So it changes the fish's behavior. Interesting. That's very
interesting. There's that mushroom that does that to ants, too.
Yeah. I was just thinking that myself. It makes an ant, like, jump off a cliff or something like that?
Yeah. Climb to the highest part of a tree and jump off, and then it dies so that the mushroom can consume its body and fruit, and then the cycle goes on.
Mm-hmm. That's wild. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's the stuff of... there's
nightmares. This should have been our Halloween episode, maybe.
That's true. You know, I mean, actually thinking on that one, it's not something on our list, but we get something here called a mud dauber. A mud dauber is a type of hornet. It looks a lot like a tarantula hawk. So
yeah.
We've seen tarantula hawks down in the desert, and those are one of those things we don't have here, but man, are they weird. They actually will...
They're kind of parasitic as well, right?
Yeah, they lay their eggs inside of a tarantula. And then the eggs of the tarantula hawk will kind of come alive inside of the tarantula, and then they
consume the tarantula
from the inside out.
Wow! Yeah, I remember hearing about that when I guided in the Grand Canyon. Tarantula hawks are they're pretty scary looking. Like, I would not want to get
stung
by a tarantula.
They're like 2 inches. There's a guy that actually went around exposing himself to all the most painful things in the world, you know? And
what a masochist!
I know, totally. He actually rated
it was
as
in
like,
the name of science.
Yeah.
One of the top five most painful stings in the world, actually.
Was it from a tarantula hawk?
Yeah. Luckily, we don't get those. We get mud daubers. Yeah. They're very similar, and they're the sting from a mud dauber is going to be pretty bad as well.
Are they parasitic as well, the mud daubers?
I don't think so. I don't think so.
Okay.
Yeah, but they look just as scary. They don't have as mean of intent, though.
Interesting. Yeah. Hornets are definitely a hole in my naturalist knowledge. Around what they do and much about them. But, I remember learning about the tarantula hawks. Those are wild.
Well, I mean, you have to for your guests so that, you make sure people are safe.
Yeah, especially when you take people down there.
They're not going to die or anything, but
they're not specifically aggressive towards people. Rouse them up. Yeah. I mean, I don't know what this guy did to get stung, you know, to force them to... Steve Irwin moves of, you know.
it is kind of wild, but, you know, Liz and I, we guide down there in the desert a lot of the times, and we've been out there for over 10 years, and we've never seen anyone stung by it, but it's one of those things where you're looking for those bright orange wings, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they are bright. They're super bright.
Yeah.
Bright orange.
They look like a really big, really beautiful dragonfly with a massive stinger.
Mm-hmm. And
it's a good point. They do like that.
Getting closer to the end of the show, but we still have time. If folks are out there, if you want to give us a phone call in, it's 415-663-8492 if you're interested in calling in. We have either another song or jump into the next one.
Let's keep going with the we're on a roll here with these weird species, and I know we got a few more we want to talk about. So
totally, actually, this next one isn't really a species. This was more of a unique event that happened.
Okay,
this was in 2012. Liz and I were guiding out here.
Oh, here we go.
We've got to call
wrap Dallas that one up. We'll hold that one for a second.
Yeah, hold that thought. Hello, you are on the air. This is the Westmoor Naturalist Hour.
Hi, friends. This is Katie.
Hey, Katie. You know, I was just thinking about you, and one of my first oddities I found fascinating on this show was the newt ball. They still take up...
Oh, yeah, newt ball.
Newt balls. Newt balls still take up my thoughts, and I remember you introduced me to the whole concept. When a lucky lady comes to the pond, and there's only a bunch of male newts, and forms a ball, and we can all imagine why. But anyways, I digress. It's good to have you call in, Katie. What you got for us?
I got a few oddities that I'd love to put the shout out there if people have seen them in Marin.
Yeah, please do.
Okay, cool. So one I've been geeking out on recently are the coastal horned lizards.
Yeah.
And these are this really tiny, really cute lizard that has the defense of being able to shoot blood from its eyeballs.
What?
Yeah, there you go.
Are you kidding me?
They're pretty rare on the coast. And when you look at the research, we're kind of like this northernmost tip of their range. They run all the way into Baja. So I've heard rumors of potentially them being in the area, but I've actually never heard any confirmed sightings. So that's one I'd just love to know if anyone's seen around here. Like, I think Mount Diablo has a pretty good population.
That was going to be my question, was what type of environment should we would we be looking for them in? Because they look like something that lives in the desert.
Yeah, they do look like a desert lizard. They're really unique looking.
They really need soft bottom ground because they need to be able to kind of burrow in. They're not. They can only be between like 65 and 75 degrees. And they kind of like sit in the sun and need to be close to shade so they can like thermoregulate. So they really like a warm place with edges.
Mm, huh. I think our house is perfect for that. How do I call them?
Okay, the other one was that sundew. I was really excited to see it up in Humboldt County, and I've heard rumors of some people maybe seeing it on Mount Tam, in a bog on Mount Tam. And I have tried and looked, never seen it myself, so I'd love to know if other folks have seen that.
And this is the parasitic plant, right? Predatory plant.
Predatory,
right? Yeah.
Yeah.
All this talk about
really
parasitic.
It lives in like the nutrient deficient bogs, and it grows little dewy tips that capture insects because it needs the nutrients it can't get from the soil in there.
Oh, cool!
And does it like close around the insects like a Venus flytrap?
Yeah, except it looks a little... You should look it up. They're the most beautiful things.
They kind of look like passion flowers a little bit.
Yes, yeah, so I was just showing them some photos.
But they're tiny.
They're tiny.
And you were seeing them in the redwoods. Oh, yeah, they are.
So they're like tiny little insects. They're tiny little ones.
Huh.
Yeah. So they're normally, like, they a lot of times live with sphagnum moss in a bog, like a real bog. Mm-hmm. And so... I don't really know that we have that on Mount Tam, but I've still heard some folks have seen them. So I don't want to deny it, but I would like to see it.
So like a Venus flytrap, you know, except they're like longer, skinnier leaves, and they actually kind of wrap end over end on them, which is kind of cool.
Like little curly cues.
And you said they're called
sundew.
So is it... does it have, like, the look of dew on it to attract prey?
Yeah, it has, like, hairs all around it, and at the tip of each hair is, like, a glistening ball of dew.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, I can definitely see that in the picture here. Yeah. Almost looks like a centipede arm, like, up close. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So you can potentially find them out here.
Alien. We got to find a bog.
Yeah,
I don't know. I found it in Humboldt, but I haven't found it here yet.
That's awesome.
All right. I got to get these lizards in my yard, and I got to go find a bog. That's what's on my agenda this afternoon.
You know, the lizards we seem to get in our yard are alligator lizards. Those are the ones that seem the most common.
The lizards really like our native ants. And so they don't really like the invasive Argentine ants. So I could imagine them also really liking some of our sandy, cliffy areas that have, like, still have native ant populations. I think that's why they don't do well well around humans.
The little ants that create lines and annoy the heck out of us, those are Argentinian ants?
I think so.
Oh, I didn't know
that. Yeah, they're not our native ant colonies.
Oh, really? Really? So the ones that come inside and will wreak havoc on leftovers are...
Often.
Oh, didn't know that. Huh. Okay. Makes me feel better about destroying their ant colonies. Anyways, those are great, Katie. Appreciate you calling in. The Mountain Dew...
Sundew,
and the coastal horn lizard, which actually we were talking about that before, and I thought how interesting that was that it shoots blood out of its eyes. Like, what a weird adaptation.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh,
odd adaptation.
I could talk for all day about horned lizards.
That's even better than the adaptation that
turkey vultures
where they projectile vomit I mean, that's even better. Shooting blood out of your eyes. Come on, that's a good one. That is a good one. And is it like a? Is there blood like specifically?
Yeah. What's in their blood that would be bad for whatever's
yeah,
trying to eat them.
Yeah, they eat the ants, and ants have that formic acid. So the formic acid that makes up the main part of their diet of ants makes it, like, you know, a little acidic.
I don't know enough about ants. I'm just thinking, is that a whole other episode.
Like, it probably makes that smell. It's the same thing with why ants, some ants will take, like, a bath in a, I mean, some birds will take a bath in an ant's nest because the formic acid kind of cleans their feathers.
So you're saying, if I'm getting this correctly, that this lizard shoots acidic eye blood.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. All right. I want to make sure I got that right. that's going to go now in my regular thoughts, along with newt balls and other things that will occasionally pop up in my mind for just because they're cool. But we're getting to the end of our show here.
Yeah. Well, it was nice to talk to you guys.
Thanks for calling in, Katie. That was awesome.
Well,
see ya.
Bye. Bye, Katie. That's great. We still got a few more minutes here.
You got to finish up your train of thought there.
I might as well at least go finish that up. But it was actually less of a species and more of an event. We actually had a meteor land in Marin County in October of 2012. Liz and I were actually out here guiding at nighttime. And I remember it was the longest, you know, shooting star meteor I've ever seen in my life. And it was like a full 4 seconds across the sky, lit up bright green, and was like, man, if that felt like it actually was accompanied by us by a, like a boom and at night, and it felt like that landed somewhere here in Marin. And sure as could be, it actually landed like it broke up as soon as it kind of hit the atmosphere, but landed in a few different places, and they found different chunks of it in Novato.
That's wild,
right?
You know, there has been meteors I've seen out here in the sky where I'm like, should I be concerned if that's going to hit Earth? When I saw a few years ago, again, bright green one just took its time going across the sky. I'm like, I'm kind of concerned here. But that's pretty wild that when you witnessed landed in Marin County or part of it.
And they were able to find fragments. You know, so there is like fragments out there from that particular meteor, which is kind of cool. So
that is pretty wild. And even recently, another guide on the water saw a meteor breaking up in the sky. Mm-hmm. We just had a meteor shower not too long ago.
We have them like quarterly.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. It's true. But this was a good one. Like when we had some clear nights out there recently and tons of shooting stars, and apparently one of them was broke up in the sky.
We've been seeing a lot. That's kind of the best part about the winter time out there. Yep. The winter sky is like nighttime paddling. It's the fog's not there, so you can actually see the night sky, you know? So
I only know winter constellations. I never see them in the summer.
It's true. It's a good point. It's especially with those clear nights. You get the light show above as well as below. It's pretty cool.
Totally. Well, we're just about the end here. I do want to go out on
specific song.
This is an oddity show, and you know, my dad, I grew up, he loved Pink Floyd, and a lot of Pink Floyd stuff is out there as it is.
And he was an odd duck.
And he was, you know, and this particular song is one of those, what's the name of it, Seamus? Can you read the whole thing?
It's several species of small furry animals gathered together in a cave, and then there's
There's a lot more to it.
There's more to it, but that's the start of the title.
It's one of those like songs that was odd to me as a child, and even as an adult, I've learned to appreciate the oddity of it all. So it's kind of fun. Enjoy.
All right, friends. Well, tune in to us in a few weeks. We'll have a new guest on the show. We'll see you.
And actually, our next show, we actually have Hannah Hinley, one of our really good friends.
And Dick Evans from In the Shadow of the Bridge, their new book. Can't wait to talk all about it.
Awesome.
Yeah, so if you get a chance in the meantime, go pick up their book from the bookstore here in Point Reyes. Mm-hmm.
Oh, sweet.
Or Wayfinder has it, too.
Yeah.
What's it called?
In the Shadow of the Bridge.
I just wanted to double check, make sure I heard that correctly. Okay. We'll see you all in a few weeks.
Have a good day.